On the Sufficiency of Human Testimony for the Proof of Miracles by Thomas Chalmers. Mr. Hume's Objection to the Truth of Miracles. Section 1. On the Origin of Our Belief and Testimony. The following is Dr. Campbell's abstract of Hume's argument on the subject of miracles. Quote, "Experience is our only guide in reasoning concerning matters of fact. Experience is in some things variable, in some things uniform. A variable experience gives rise only to probability, and uniform experience amounts to a proof. Probability always supposes an opposition of experiments and observations, where the one side is found to overbalance the other, and to produce a degree of evidence proportioned to the superiority. In such cases, we must balance the opposite experiments and deduct the lesser number from the greater in order to know the exact force of the superior evidence. Our belief or assurance of any fact from the report of eyewitnesses is derived from no other principle than experience. That is, our observation of the veracity of human testimony and of the usual conformity of facts to the report of witnesses. Now, if the fact attested partakes of the marvelous, if it is such as has seldom fallen under our observation, here is a contest of two opposite experiences, of which the one destroys the other, as far as its force goes, and the superior can only operate on the mind by the force which remains. The very same principle of experience, which gives us a certain degree of assurance in the testimony of witnesses, gives us also, in this case, another degree of assurance against the fact which they endeavor to establish, from which contradiction there necessarily arises a counterpoise and mutual destruction of belief and authority. Further, if the fact affirmed by the witnesses, instead of being only marvelous, is really miraculous, if, besides, the testimony considered apart and in itself amounts to an entire proof, in that case there is proof against proof, of which the strongest must prevail, but still with a diminution of its force in proportion to that of its antagonist. A miracle is a violation of the laws of nature, and as a firm and unalterable experience has established these laws, the proof against a miracle from the very nature of the fact is as entire as any argument from experience can possibly be imagined. And if so, it is an undeniable consequence that it cannot be surmounted by any proof whatever from testimony. A miracle, therefore, however attested, can never be rendered credible, even in the lowest degree." End quote. And the following is the outset of Dr. Campbell's reply. Quote, "In answer to this, I propose first to prove that the whole is built upon a false hypothesis, that the evidence of testimony is derived solely from experience, which seems to be an axiom of this writer, is at least not so incontestable a truth as he supposes it is. That, on the contrary, testimony hath a natural and original influence on belief antecedent to experience, will, I imagine, easily be evinced. For this purpose, let it be remarked that the earliest assent which is given to testimony by children, and which is previous to all experience, is in fact the most unlimited. That by a gradual experience of mankind it is gradually contracted and reduced to narrower bounds. To say, therefore, that our diffidence in testimony is the result of experience is more philosophical, because more consonant to truth, than to say that our faith in testimony has this foundation. Accordingly, youth, which is unexperienced, is credulous. Age, on the contrary, is distrustful. Exactly the reverse would be the case were this author's doctrine just. End quote. Such is the opening of the controversy between Hume and Campbell on the subject of miracles, and wherewith the latter ushers in his celebrated reply to the argument of the former. We have long stood in doubt of the validity of that reply, notwithstanding the singular acumen and dexterity and power of expression by which it is characterized. We still hold it to be neither a clear nor a conclusive one, and do therefore feel an insecurity and a want of completeness in the Christian defense whenever this skeptical reasoning of Mr. Hume is again advanced by any of those more recent writers who have succeeded him on the side of infidelity. We, in the first place, doubt whether he is right in the theory which he proposes respecting the origin of our faith and testimony. In opposition to Hume, who grounds it on experience, he makes it a principle sui generis, in the mental constitution, or an aboriginal instinct of the understanding. We shall in the course of the following discussion have to remark on certain phenomena of our belief and testimony which incline us to resolve it, with Mr. Hume, into our faith in the constancy of nature. But we are anxious to have it understood that the refutation, which we shall venture to propose, neither requires nor presupposes any absolute deliverance upon this question. We undertake to prove his conclusion to be wrong, not because, but although his premises should be right. We are inclined to think them right. But though we should be in error here, this is not an error by which our counter-argument to Mr. Hume is in the least affected. It is of no consequence whether we affirm with him the truth of his own principle respecting the origin of our faith and testimony. There is a difference between affirming it and allowing it. The latter is what we certainly do, and a refutation should be held all the more decisive if it can afford to an adversary those very assumptions on which his argument is built. But secondly, though Dr. Campbell were right in the view he gave respecting the origin of our faith and testimony, we do not see that this is of decisive avail on his side of the controversy. Even though experience were not the source of our belief and testimony, it may still be the measure by which to regulate the degree of confidence that we ought to repose in it. The faith may come from one quarter, and yet the test by which to compute the extent of that faith, or the amount of credit due in particular instances, may come from another. We may or we may not be born with the precipitate tendency to believe in the testimony of our fellow men, and yet if it be found in experience that testimony in certain given circumstances had deceived us at the rate of once in 10 times, it is precisely at that rate that we should deduct from our confidence in the testimony offered in these circumstances. And our doing so would meet the approval of every enlightened understanding. So that whatever experience Mr. Hume can allege against the testimony which has been given for the miracles of Christianity, whether it relates to the characteristics of the testimony or to its subject matter, the improbability grounded on such experience will have all to be grappled with, an improbability, we fear, which cannot be neutralized, and far less answered, by any metaphysical statement respecting the principle of our belief on the question which of them is original and which of them is but derived and secondary in the constitution of human nature. And thirdly, this assertion of our faith and testimony being an original and distinct principle from the faith of experience, so far from clearing the question or advancing it towards a settlement, seems but to make it more puzzling and inextricable than before. Dr. Campbell charges Mr. Hume, when the latter alleges experience in opposition to testimony, with the attempt to balance things which are not homogeneous. Now, it is precisely, if not homogeneous, that it seems impossible to arbitrate betwixt them. Certain it is that the rarity of an event demands a greater amount of testimony for the establishment of our conviction in its truth, and greatest of all when the event is so rare as to be miraculous. But the question, what argumentation of testimony on the one hand will overcome the argumentation of improbability from a deficient experience on the other, seems of impossible solution should these two not be homogeneous elements. If not homogeneous, they are not commensurable, so that the introduction of this principle on the part of Dr. Campbell, instead of helping on the question to a deliverance, has only mystified it to our understanding, and made of it altogether a more baffling and hopeless speculation. We on these grounds are not satisfied with the soundness of Dr. Campbell's refutation, and we shall attempt to substitute another. It is certainly not essential to the validity of the second that the insufficiency of the first should be exposed, yet both from the interest of the subject in itself and also from our wish to deliver the argument on the side of Christianity of all that we hold to be questionable or weak, we should like to prosecute a little further our inquiry into this supposed distinction between faith and testimony and the faith of experience, and that chiefly with the view of stating our main exceptions to the reasoning of Dr. Campbell. After that we have observed once or oftener the prior term of any particular sequence in nature followed up by its posterior term, it is not necessary that both should come into view on any new occasion to make us believe that both have on that occasion actually taken place. For this purpose, it is enough that any one of the terms should be observed by us, and it is a matter of indifference which of them. If we have seen the prior term A, we conclude that it will be followed by the posterior term B, though we should not see B. Or, if we have seen the posterior term B, we infer that it has been preceded by the prior term A, though A, in like manner, has not been seen by us. For our belief in the existence of the one term, even of that which we have seen, we have had the evidence of observation. For our belief in the existence of the other, or of that which we have not seen, it would perhaps be more correct, and certainly more distinctive, to say that we have had the evidence of experience. Ere proceeding further, it may be proper to remark that it is not necessary for the two terms in question to be contiguous in the order of successive nature. The truth of the inference depends not on the closeness, but on the certainty of the connection between them. Between A and F, there may be a train of intermediate events. Yet, if A always originate that train, and F be always the concluding term of it, we should, from the observation of either singly, conclude the existence of the other with as great confidence as if they stood related in immediate succession. It is of no consequence to the argument whether F be the posterior or the postream term to A, the posterior term of a sequence, or the postream term of a series. Now, an event in nature and the testimony which affirms it stand related to each other precisely in this way. The one is the posterior, or if you will, the postream term to the other. There may be intermediate steps between the event and the testimony, its impression on the belief of the witness, its continued hold of his memory, the opportunity of narrating it to others, the circumstances which prompted him to make the communication, and lastly, the communication itself. There is here a progression of terms, each related to the one immediately next it in the way of antecedent and consequent. And there seems nothing in the process at all distinguishable from any other chain of sequences, when from the seen and the present we infer the anterior and the unseen term, lying back at some distance either more or less remote in the train of causation. To infer the reality of an event from the testimony which relates it seems in no way distinguishable from the process by which we infer the reality of some antecedent term in any other observed progression in nature from a subsequent term now manifesting itself to the senses. It is an inference grounded on our past observation of the conjunction between the event and the testimony. Or, in other words, the evidence of testimony seems resolvable into that of experience. Now, this is not the opinion of Dr. Campbell, nor of any, we believe, who have taken part with him in the controversy against Mr. Hume. He holds the evidence of testimony to be distinct from that of experience and resolvable into a separate and original principle of its own. It serves unnecessarily to complicate a subject when first principles are multiplied without cause. But when to serve a cause, that which is pronounced upon as a first principle is far from being obviously so. It goes to mystify a subject and to weaken exceedingly the impression of the argument which is founded thereupon. The reason which Dr. Campbell alleges for faith and testimony being an instinctive and original principle, and not derived from any other, is that it is strongest in infancy, and that it becomes weaker as we advance to manhood and old age. He would hold it, therefore, to be apart from the faith of experience, seeing that experience does not strengthen but rather weaken our faith and testimony. It is our diffidence, rather than our confidence in testimony, which seems to be the result of experience. And on the unsuspecting trust and simplicity of childhood, contrasted with the growing jealousy and slowness of belief, which are characteristic of those who have had many years of experience and been much conversant with the world, would he ground the conclusion that our faith and testimony is one of the primary and independent principles of our nature? We have already said that even though this were conceded to Dr. Campbell, it is by no means sure that it ought to be regarded as of any service in his argument. Though we should grant that it was not experience which originated our credit and testimony, yet from his own account it would appear that experience limited the degree of credit which was due to it. Faith and testimony would seem, by his own account, to operate as a blind and undiscerning instinct which led, in the first instance, astray, till rectified by a subsequent experience. If it be the office of experience to regulate and restrain the headlong tendencies of the original instinct, Dr. Campbell will not deny that this is her rightful office, and that on the whole she discharges it rightly. This is very like bringing the decisions of our intuitive faith and testimony to the test of experience, or making experience the arbiter of when we ought and when we ought not to repose our confidence in the testimony of others. At this rate, experience, if not the originator, is at least the corrector of our belief and testimony, and after all, supplies the rule or the measure by which we ascertain the degree of credit that is due to it. This would leave Hume's argument, such as it is, as much or as little in possession of the ground as before, and we fear that this assertion of our faith and testimony as a separate and original principle of man's constitution has in no way helped, but on the contrary injured the cause. But let us try to ascertain what this argument of Dr. Campbell amounts to. There is really nothing in that diffidence of the veracity of others which he has noticed that is at all inconsistent with its derivation from experience. The child who has observed, once, the conjunction between an event and the testimony which relates it, is in the same circumstances, with regard to the sequence, as the child who has observed, once, the conjunction between a stroke on the table with his spoon and the noise that proceeds from it. In the latter case, it will anticipate a repetition of the noise from any stroke upon any substance, and in the former case it will infer the truth of an event from any testimony of any witness. The confidence in both instances is alike strong and alike indiscriminating, and in both instances is checked and limited in the very same way. So long as the child continues to strike on the table, or on any sonorous substance whatever, it will experience the wonted noise. So long as it hears the testimony of a sincere witness, it will experience in the corresponding fact the truth of his attestation. But at this stage it will expect a noise from all sorts of substances, and at this stage, too, it will count on the truth of all sorts of testimony. The whole amount of the matter is that it has not yet learned to sort and to discriminate, and the precise office of experience is to enable it to do so. This is all the amount of the growing diffidence which Dr. Campbell speaks of. In the one case, the child has experienced that all impulsion will not be followed up by noise. In the other case, it has experienced that all testimony has not been preceded by the reality of that which the testimony affirms. There is a growing diffidence in the truth of testimony, just as there is a growing diffidence in the effect of impulsion. This phenomenon is realized in the one process which is by all allowed to be strictly experimental, and there is therefore nothing in this same phenomenon that bespeaks the other process not to have been strictly experimental also. Let us now attend more narrowly to what the diffidence in both cases precisely is. The child has struck its spoon upon the table and elicited a noise, and it expects to elicit the same noise by a stroke on all sorts of substances. It tries to obtain it by a like application of the instrument in its hand on other smooth surfaces, and is disappointed, as on the surface of water, on the surface of the sandy beach, or on the surface of the bed upon which it happens to be seated. There is a growing diffidence as to the effect of impulsion in the general. There is a check upon the largeness and universality of this expectation. And with just as good reason as Dr. Campbell affirms that experience begets a growing diffidence in the evidence of testimony, may it be said that experience begets a growing diffidence in the evidence of experience. The truth is that experience does not appear either to augment or diminish our general faith in the constancy of nature's sequences, though it may either augment or diminish our expectation of a given result in particular cases. The reason of this we have already endeavored to make plain. We are born with the tendency to expect similar results in similar circumstances. But there is often an apparent, without a real similarity, or a similarity in some circumstances, though not a similarity in all, and these, perhaps, the essential circumstances. It is just because at the outset of observation we overlook the differences and are more impressed by the similarities of things that in virtue of our native instinct we expect the same result in cases which have an apparent sameness, though they be really distinct from each other. The diffidence in question arises from nothing else than the correction which is subsequently laid on the indefiniteness and generality of this expectation. Experience, whose proper office is not to instruct us in the constancy of nature's sequences, but to inform us what the sequences actually are, enables us at length to discriminate between those antecedents which have but a seeming and those which have an actual identity with each other. It teaches us not to confound the things which differ, not to expect that what we have found in one case we shall always find in another, though an apparently similar case. It is in virtue of the infantine tendency to confound and to assimilate the things which be distinct that a child looks in the first instance for the same noise from the carpet that it had from the table, and it is the office of experience to limit and restrain this indefinite expectation. In regard to all those substances on which it made the trial and met with disappointment, experience begets a diffidence where before there was a confidence. But in regard to the material on which it made its first experiment, it retains unabated confidence, or rather a confidence which grows and strengthens with every repetition of the experiment. The child has lost the indiscriminate confidence which it had at the outset of its experimental career, just because experience has taught it to discriminate. It loses the a priori confidence wherewith, at one time, it would have expected a noise in striking on wood or paper or the loose earth beneath its feet, but it does not lose its confident expectation of a noise by impulsion on the table, or, to speak more correctly, by impulsion upon wood. Experience teaches to distinguish the things which be distinct, and thus, while it nullifies one set of expectations, it fortifies and builds up another set. And it is just this, and nothing else, which takes place in testimony. The growing diffidence of a child in the general power of testimony to indicate truth is, in every respect, the same, with its growing diffidence, in the general power of impulsion to effect a noise. Having once experienced testimony to be true, it expects it to be true in all time coming, as, having once elicited a noise from a stroke, it expects a noise from a stroke in all time coming. The first individual of whose testimony it had the observation, one may conceive to be actuated by the high principle of never deceiving a child, and the experience of his truth will be as uniform as the experience of a noise by impulsion on a table. But the second individual may occasionally amuse himself with practicing on the credulity of children, and in his testimony that expectation of truth, which was quite general and unexpected at the first, will meet with disappointment. This is the whole amount of that diffidence in testimony which has been noticed by Dr. Campbell. There is a growing diffidence as to the truth of testimony in the gross, but no such growing diffidence as to the truth of particular species of testimony. The child learns to discriminate between A, who never deceives, and B, who does so occasionally. Just as it learns to discriminate between the table that never misgives its noisy response to the stroke of a spoon and the sand that never yields it. Experience has taught him a growing diffidence in the testimony of B, but, so far from being its proper and exclusive office to beget a diffidence in testimony, the very same experience also teaches him a growing confidence in the testimony of A. But the little learner will not only be taught by experience to discriminate between man and man, he will learn by experience to discriminate between the characteristics in general of a true and that of a false testimony. Just as he is taught by experience to expect a noise, not from the individual table only, but from everything of the same material, so will he be tutored by experience to expect truth, not from the individual alone, who never deceived him, but from every individual bearing the same marks of veracity. In the school of experience, he will be exercised and make daily progress in the recognition of these marks, and become more intelligent as he advances to manhood in the natural signs of honesty, the manner and the tone and the whole expression of moral earnestness. He will learn to read the veracity of a witness in the air, and the distinctness and the simplicity and withal the circumstantial nature of his testimony. He will come to know how to derive a further confirmation from the state and circumstances of the reporter, from the condition of life he occupies, and which may be such as makes him peculiarly alive to a sense of honor, from the utter absence of every inducement that could lead him to falsify, and from direct knowledge or information of the character that he bears and of the high-toned principle by which he is actuated. Experience may lead our young disciple to be diffident of some testimony, but not of this testimony, of the testimony that is accompanied by an opposite set of characteristics, but not of the testimony whose characteristics we have now enumerated and which are specifically distinct from the other. He learns to expect truth or the want of it in man from the marks of character which are presented to him, just as he learns to expect sonorousness or the want of it in the body from the materials which are presented to him. It makes no difference to our argument between the two cases that the one subject is greatly more complex than the other, or that a greater number of particulars must be considered ere we ascertain the truthfulness of an individual man than are necessary to be considered ere we ascertain the sonorousness of an individual body. There are antecedents and consequents in both processes, and the connection between them is not the less real, that in the one process, the term which is presented to view is more difficult to be estimated than in the other process. The inference in both cases is alike experimental, notwithstanding. In looking to the material subject, we infer a sonorousness on the observation of certain marks wherewith this quality has, in all past experience, stood associated. In looking to the moral subject, we infer a truthfulness on the observation of certain marks wherewith this quality has, in all past experience, stood associated. In the cases where we do not meet with these marks, we have learned by experience to be diffident of testimony. But in the cases where we do meet with these marks, we have learned at the very same school, even the school of experience, to be confident in testimony. When Dr. Campbell says that experience teaches us to be diffident of testimony, we reply that this wholly depends on the marks or characters wherewith this testimony is associated. The same experience which teaches us to be diffident of the testimony that presents to notice the usual marks of falsehood teaches us to be confident in the testimony that presents to notice the usual marks of truth. Dr. Campbell affirms in the general that experience begets a diffidence in testimony. We reply, not in all testimony, or when it is testimony associated with the usual concomitants of truth, not in such testimony. It is thus that in opposition to Dr. Campbell, it may be contended that our faith in testimony does not rest on any principle different from our experience of its truth. If we have found that in all past cases a certain mode of relating an event stands conjoined as the posterior term with the reality of the event itself as the prior term, it is on this finding, and for aught we can see, on this alone, that we, in all time coming, ground our belief of any event, when related in the same mode and amid the same circumstances. The diffidence which Dr. Campbell speaks of only applies to the testimony which is delivered in a different way and under different circumstances. He has used the term testimony in its generality, when he should have distinguished between one mode of testimony and another. the one bearing those distinct and specific marks which we have experienced to be indicative of truth, the other bearing its own peculiar and distinct marks also, which are specifically diverse from the former, and which we have experienced to be indicative of falsehood. The same experience which begets a diffidence in the latter testimony begets a confidence in the former. And we see in this department the working of the same uniform principle which obtains in all other departments of observation. It is just the principle which leads us to look for the same result in the same circumstances and for different results in different circumstances. The same experience which leads us to count on the sonorousness of wood, one sort of matter, and the insonorousness of sand, another sort of matter, leads us to count on the truth of one sort of testimony and the falsehood of another sort of testimony. Dr. Campbell, by making our faith and testimony a distinct principle in our intellectual constitution from our faith and experience, hath mystified his argument and so far weakened it. In testimony, as in everything else, there is a diffidence in cases of an observed disjunction between the report and the event, and a confidence in the opposite cases of an observed conjunction, just as there is a diffidence in cases of an observed disjunction between a stroke and a noise, and a confidence in the opposite cases of an observed conjunction. The conjunction may, either in the one department or the other, be so unaccepted as to advance the confidence into a certainty different in kind, as relating to different objects, the moral or the physical, but a certainty equal in degree, and alike based upon the evidence of observation in both. But even should, notwithstanding all that we have said, should Campbell's instinctive faith and testimony be sustained, this will not embarrass or impair our argument. It is not because it would prejudice any refutation of ours that we desire to set it aside, but because we hold ourselves to be independent of its aid. We do not think that the imagination of such an instinct helps, but neither do we think that, if admitted, it hinders the cause. Although there were a peculiar mental instinct in our constitution, by which we felt and estimated the force of testimony, this does not hinder that, over and above, there may be a superiority of experimental evidence in its favor. This last is what we attempt to demonstrate. And that, too, even in the case of miracles, where Mr. Hume alleges the superiority of the experience against the testimony to be quite overwhelming. It is on this, and without having recourse to any peculiar instinct, that we would rest the strength of our argument. We think that our refutation has at least a greater obviousness to recommend it than that of Dr. Campbell's, and, on the other hand, should his be sustained by any as a valid refutation, this does not stand in the way of ours, but only affords two solutions instead of one for the difficulty in question. Yet, for our own part, we cannot help the impression of a cause being injured by an obscure argument, even though otherwise it should be strongly and abundantly propped by such arguments as are distinct and obvious to every understanding. And we do think that the allegation of a peculiar instinct for testimony has wrought this very mischief in the controversy which now engages us, it being, in the first place, not very obvious in itself, and secondly, though admitted as to its existence, furnishing no certain data by which to estimate the argumentative strength which should be assigned to it, so that an experimental refutation seems still to be called for. Certain it is that in all arguments the unnecessary multiplication of first principles ought to be avoided. This has more than once been resorted to for the defense of religion, but not, we fear, without giving to its enemies the impression of a desperate cause. When Hume alleged our want of experience in the making of worlds, and would have built his atheism on the assertion that the world was a singular effect, this was met by Reed and Stewart with their counter-affirmation that the argument for design, as indicated by the beneficial adaptations which our universe exhibits, was not grounded on experience at all, but that this design could be read immediately by the mind, through a distinct faculty of prompt and peculiar discernment, which they were pleased to ascribe to it. And in like manner, when the same infidel philosopher alleged our want of experience for miracles, and would have built his deism on the assertion that our variable and defective experience for the truth of testimony could never so outweigh our uniform experience against the truth of miracles, as to make it possible that the credit of such extraordinary events should ever be established by the report of our fellow men. This was met by Dr. Campbell with the assertion of an evidence in testimony apart from experience and independent of experience. It was certainly a signal honor done to the intellectual tactics of Mr. Hume that for the protection of our cause, two new principles had to be invented, wherewith to complicate still more the philosophy of our mental constitution. Yet without such device, we think, that in both instances the mischief of his argument might be neutralized, and that without the allegation of any mystic or peculiar tact whatever, both our belief of contrivance in nature and our belief of miracles from testimony might be made to rest on an experimental basis. This audio recording was read by Michael Ives. I hope you found it enlightening and edifying. Visit westportexperiment.com, where I write about parish missions, the care of souls, and all things reformed.